experiments in which they see evidence that they're going to be able to create single atom transistors. As you know from Moore's Law, Mr. Moore of, I think it was the Intel Corporation, way back in the late 60s, predicted that something like every 18 months, as we develop integrated circuits, we're going to be doubling the number of transistors on a state-of-the-art chip every 18 months. And the computer programs are going to double the lines of code every 2 years. And right now there are thousands and thousands of lines of code that are operating all of those microprocessors that are in your automobile. The emission control computer is just one of them, and the computer that's controlling the transmission, the automatic transmission, and so on. And there are other microprocessors controlling the instrument panel. So you double the number of lines of code every 2 years, you double the number of transistors on a computing integrated circuit every something like 18 months. And so when Mr. Moore, when Mr. Moore made that prediction way back in something like 1967 or so, I'm not quite sure the exact year, this doubling every 18 months, people were absolutely positive they're going to run out of steam after, 10 years or so. And here we are, let me think, 45 years beyond his original prediction, and 45 years later, it is essentially still true. But we're getting, it's becoming more and more difficult. People are predicting that until you get down to the atomic level of the integrated circuits, it's going to be difficult to keep doing it. So, interesting article you brought to our attention. I'm sure there's a lot more to it. I didn't dig into it all the way. I'll turn it over to you first, Wes, and then maybe, John, you want to make some comments on what you've gotten out of the article. N2XJM, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wes.
Yes, this is Ian. Good evening, everybody. There are a few events that are actually taking place. One of the events is the creation of the transistor, but that actually happened in Australia. And there was a group of physicists that was based on University of New South Wales in Purdue University. Actually, to explain the scientific involvement, you got to find out that the Australia is historically attached to a Great Britain science, and it was Australian discovery, but was pretty much backed up by the Royal Academy of Science. In this particular situation, the Moore's Law was actually predicting something that might happen in the year 2024, and it's happening now. Let me jump into it. There are a few things that needs to be said. In 2002, IBM scientists were first announcing the work on the single atom, although due to the precision required, it was hold to your chair. Mechanical, it was a mechanical manipulation. It wasn't any kind of electronic or ionization. It was mechanical manipulator. N2XJN, hold on. That was used. So actually it was toggling bistable atoms via mechanical switching of bond angles. What they did is they have had a fork. And the fork was made out of crystal. And the crystal was vibrating with their own frequency. So they used a generator, and they used the generator to tune that fork to this frequency of resonance. At the end of one arm of the fork, they glue a things that they were using to mechanically manipulate with the other passenger. The course that I have on the atomic switch, actually I sent you another video which has few links, and I sent it to Bernie as well as the supporting material. Dolce says that better is to see than the thousand words. So you have a number of videos in this area. Atomic switch, moving individual atoms. Reading what I see from one of the frames of that video. So anybody can Google for atomic switch. They will reversibly switch the state of bistable atom by direct mechanical manipulation of bond angle using a dynamic force microscope. Individual duct diameter of SI, gosh, what is SI? I forgot. Table SI.
Set a
priorities of what goes on in the house. The highest priority is the fluids have to flow, both in and out. Second highest priority is electricity has to flow, the heat has to flow, and the automobiles, the generator has to work, the alternator has to work, otherwise your automobile is going to stop working pretty soon. And I also saw another object in the sky on Monday afternoon. It's very difficult to explain, a moving object. Won't go into that one right now. But in the case of a transistor, let me drop. Most transistors really have three leads going to them, the equivalent of an emitter, base, and collector, or the equivalent of a source, drain, and collector. Oh, wait a minute. Source, base, and drain. I think that's what it's called. But you know what I mean. So most transistors contain three elements. And conductivity changes across two of those elements as you apply voltage or current to the third element. That's the way a usual transistor behaves and is used. And I'm having trouble believing that a single atom can have three terminals. What I think is going on here is that as that single atom moves from one location to another location, that in one location you call it a digital one, in the other location you call it a digital zero.
Correct.
Okay, so it's the motion that is representing the state. So it's a single atom recording object, if I understand correctly. And so it's part of a transistor-like object in which you can order it to go from one location to the other location.
So, you see, like, remember the old 1960 computers with the ferrite rings? So now we have a positioning as the memory module.
And therefore the atom in this case is many orders of magnitude smaller than those ferrite rings. They were really so-called core memory. Hard to believe, but some of those core memories are still flying. I know that they were being used on the EA-6B aircraft as a very highly reliable memory system. That's the good news, but they don't have very many kilobytes or megabytes of memory, and that particular function apparently didn't need it. So we've come a long way in memory devices, a modern-day flash memory, solid-state hard drive, so to speak, of gigabytes and terabytes. Boy, I imagine there is an equivalent to Moore's Law as to how many bits of data you can store per cubic centimeter. There probably is. So these atomic-level memory device is what I think you're calling it, is what I would call it. I think they called it a transistor, but that may be stretching it a little bit because I think quite a bit of other hardware is around that memory storage device.
Molecular memory storage.
Okay. Did the article say how much of a breakthrough this was? You gave a hint at that. Is that Moore's Law appear to say that we're not going to be there until the year 2024, and we seem to be there at the end of 2013. So it appears that we're 10 or 11 years ahead of Moore's Law on this one. Although I suspect that this is a laboratory curiosity at this point. It is not a fully developed and implemented product. And I wonder if the article said how long it will take to make it into a product. In 2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, actually what they're trying to do is find a quantum computers to be able to memorize data very similar way that the transistor base were able to remember on, off, and one. And zero states. Actually, it was 1 plus 1 equals 1, 1 plus 0 equals 1, 0 plus put into place and then physically being able to switch the position of the single atoms to be able to create a memory. But I have something that is interesting here. I've been digging into this area with a great fascination and extremely deep. I found also that at a certain point you're actually acquiring in 1 hour that which you were acquiring in 1 week before. It's just a natural progression when you understand that. The thing is that in order for them to be able to switch the position, change the position, they have to break the nuclear bond. You remember that from the spectrum of electromagnetic waves, what each one of the frequency or the regions in that spectrum could do with the physics solid matter. So usually we say a radio wave, which is the typical radio wave, should do nothing that much. Then we going to the infrared, and infrared really doesn't do much. It's an excitation. The ultraviolet creates an excitation as well. I forgot about the microwave. It's rotation to the physical matter. Now, the photon, which belongs to each one of the region, is capable of affecting the matter. But then we go to the X-rays. And what the X-rays does, X-ray is capable of breaking the molecular bonds. That's why they had a problem to do it, because they had to create a lot of X-rays. So they decided to mechanically be able to switch the position of an atom. I don't believe that they will have something like a micro robot that would be able to play with the molecular structure breaking the bonds. But the interesting fact is that we coming to the very critical point, which is you, Dick, with everything that you represent, you are made from an atom. Everything around, and the microphone that you keep in your hand, is made from an atom. Although, strangely, I found that 1956 pattern that I'm working on is working the way as it was described, and is giving a proper result. When you look at the molecular the type table of contents, the table of a Mendeleev table of elements, you look at the molecular number, and that number actually tells you how many protons do you have. But then you have to find out that the number of protons is somehow corresponding to the number of the electrons that gives you the molecular number. Now, you can you can lose the electron, still the atom will be alike. You can lose the neutron, and still the atom will be sort of alike, but it would be still in line of the atom of the particle substance. But when you try to deal with the protons, now you're creating a daughter. You're creating a different metal or different substance. So it looks like, right on the disk, someone can create a map of a disk. Map of a disk, And then based over the atomic map of a dick, one could actually create another dick. Could create based on that map, because what we're doing is actually we're playing with the atoms, and we're trying to put atom on the top of an atom and the top of an atom. Now the future engineering could be done with the based on the map with a particle size or shape of whatever we're trying to create, which then leads of to another area at which we're talking about total disaster, because nothing will have a value. When we will be able to create the atomic the engineering to the point of being able to create anything that we want, that it's sort of like a power of God, if I could say, at that point. And to explain.
Let me back up a little bit, first, Wes. This single atom memory device, did they hint about how fast it can operate in microseconds, nanoseconds, picoseconds? Did they give you a hint as to how fast it can switch from one state to the other? Back to you on that one, Wes.
It depends on the frequency of the fork. So the fork in here is being used as the device that is creating a vibration. And at the end of the fork, you have a spike. And that spike is then moving, so that this one arm of the fork that has the spike. Now that spike is moving with the frequency of the resonance of that fork. The fork is made from silicon, from quartz. I'm sorry. Based on that, they are able to see where the positioning will be, and that they actually talk about the problem that I have, and finally they found how to switch that. So if the frequency of the quartz could be 100 megahertz, then we're talking about the frequency of switching of 100 megahertz times the number of the elements. But what I'm saying is, Dick, if we are able not only to switch, but actually put the atom based on the atom, we can create anything and everything we want to. There is no problem with metals, and there's no problem with the biological matter or bodies. That's what everything is going to. And to achieve.
I'm going to agree with you a little bit, Wes, that it's moving in that direction. But to say it's got a long way to go is quite a euphemistic or understatement. I think a human being consists of something like 10 to the 13 neurons, and each neuron consists of a large number of molecules, and those molecules consist of a number of atoms. So the total number of atoms in a human being, you and I can find out that number, and maybe it's a 10 to the 18 or 10 to the 16, it's some very big number. To construct a human being where 10 to the 16 atoms are assembled in the right order, at the right time, in the right positions, obviously no human being is going to live long enough to do that, even for even constructing a fingernail, if you know what I mean. The total number of atoms is much too great. With a huge amount of automation, yes, I see the possibility, but there's a long way to go before anybody's going to play God as I see it. Mother Nature has been doing it her way for 4.5 billion years on this particular planet. It took her a long time to get to where we are, and there it required the majority. It required a kind of survival of the fittest. The total number of species alive on planet today is a very small fraction of the total number of species that have ever lived on this planet. I mean, there's a tremendous number of things that have come and gone to get to where we are. So I don't see people at the atomic repeater. Time out. I don't see mankind at the atomic level assembling any kind of significant biological organism, not even a flatworm or a mosquito. I don't see that happening for a long time. Let me see what John is his impression of those YouTube videos and the, no, it's not YouTube video, but you know what I mean. The material that Wes presented. Hopefully you got a lot further than I did, John. Wonder what is your impression of speed, how soon can it possibly be a product, and where is this going and how long is it going to take to get there? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, I only received one web element from Wes, and I read that. What I did find very fascinating, there were no videos, was the fact that this transistor that they think they've developed with one atom not only can do what you're talking about, but it can do it a multiple function at the same time, because that's what computer, quantum computer work is going to be. I found that. They don't explain what they mean, but evidently it can change states, or it can be in many locations at one time. So it's not only the memory function that you spoke about, it's also part of decision-making, that it could do the memory function and decision-making all at once. And it will bring up the speed of computing by ridiculous numbers. So I think it's a fascinating subject. I wish there was more. I will go on to read on the Internet. I'm going to Google some of that tomorrow and see what more I can find out about it. But I find it very interesting. But as far as creating, let me let it drop. As far as creating, yeah, I think you're right. That's very far down the line. But they may be able to mimic things in the beginning. But even if they could create atoms of gold, just think of how much work it's going to take to make a bar of gold. Never mind a human body. And then, how do you instill life into the human body? That's another subject. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I have something on it. But first, whether you treat it as a joke or you treat it as a sign of insanity, or you treat it as something that somebody with great imagination wants to say. Well, I am quite convinced that right now on my desk, at the point that I am right now, I have a sort of key to manipulate with nuclear structure. But anyhow, it's not that you do whatever you think you do. You have a molecular level. So hydrogen has one atomic number. Boron has five, so carbon has six, and so on. Nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine has nine, whatsoever. Now, you take anything that you have next to you. As energy cannot be destroyed nor created, but could change the form, we don't have a problem with the energy. But now we're talking about a physical positioning of the parts of the nuclei. Now, you can understand that you have something like an electron annihilation, which could happen under influence. What you're actually doing is that the nucleus in telling an electron, and at that point, one proton disappear. Now, when one proton disappears, the atomic number changes. Of course, we have a number of different things. One neutron appears, which is not that much big problem, but then we have a better radiation, a better radiation in form of the photon could come out directly. I'm sorry, it's not a beta, it's gamma radiation. Light of the nuclei. Anything that is happening with the nuclei is a gamma radiation. But actually, in some of the structure, we have a positron. Okay, we inhale the electron. Okay, then the neutron disappears. We have a positron radiation and one neutrino, or actually anti-neutrino radiation. Now, those are the physical particles that goes there, but what I'm saying is the effect of that is different atoms, is different substance. So let's say you could have a substance that would be, say, sodium, and then after the treatment, sodium becomes cadmium, and it's quite different animal. That's the new alchemy that is taking place right now. It's possible. So, we have a situation at which we may say, well, this is impossible, which is perfectly okay. Or we may say, well, how about if it's possible? How about if 1956 pattern was right? How about, for a moment, just for a moment, that something that was denied is not denied. The electromagnetic wave that has a very low energy level, the lowest one, because it's low frequency, at a frequency of 300 megahertz, is capable of activating a matter. And matter is able then to go to the change. And that's what I believe I was able to conform and to see it.
WGB. Well, Wesley, let me correct you. First of all, I did not say anything about you being delusional or whether it was true or whether it isn't true. I was just saying that the extrapolation of what you propose is going to take time. Okay, now remember when we talked about this before, you have an RF wave, you have a chemical composite compound in this tube, you expose it to this RF wave, and you are moving around protons or neutrons, whatever it is, and you're changing that into a different substance. I asked, what substance are you producing? So that was my question. Over to you, Dick.
A quick answer. I agree with you completely, 100%, John. What I'm producing, well, fortunately, this area of science has plenty of devices. They are very much very much easy to buy and cost pennies. So sometimes it costs extremely big amount of money. It's for $60, $70. And when I was digging out there, I see so many of them of different kinds of spectroscopy that I could have. And I'm slowly moving out right in this direction to find out what is really happening and to find out what is really going on. Now, I even went to the point at which I'm trying to use a indicator that are completely non-contaminatable, which are the color-changing substance giving me a spectral component of radiation or whatever the activation is there happening. That would be as a proof that something is going on and it's not the effect of the contamination of that measurement because of the RF. And to explain.
One of the questions you asked in the last couple RF energy and matter. And one of the best examples we have of that is a so-called microwave oven. And that microwave oven, which runs at a power level of a good fraction of a kilowatt, I think many of them run 750 watts. Let me drop. The 750 watts coming out of the magnetron in a microwave oven has a lot of influence on water molecules, because a water molecule is a bipolar object. The two hydrogens decided to group themselves together on one end of the oxygen with about 109 degrees of distance between them, and that's the so-called a positive end of the water molecule, if I've got it right, and the oxygen end, where there's no hydrogen molecules, is the negative end. So as the 750 watts of RF energy is bouncing around inside of that cavity, and because the cavity, depending on the amount of load your food creates, runs at a reasonably high Q, there probably is kilowatts of energy bouncing back and forth in the cavity. And that RF energy, from all I can tell, is affecting only the outer charged shell of electrons on those water molecules. What makes me say that is, you could say that Percy Spencer, the guy who is thought to have invented the microwave oven somewhere around 1946 or so, you could say by way of microwave ovens, we have been cooking our food for 75 years with RF energy. Not always at 2 gigs. There were times that it was done at 27 megs, a couple of hundred megs, 900 megs, 2 gigs. All kinds of frequencies have been used. It's not a very frequency-sensitive item. But we make jokes about the fact that we have been nuking our food in a microwave oven. However, 45 years of experience implies that the food has not been altered in any way other than being heated by the microwaves. The microwaves do that heating a little bit more differentially than an ordinary convection oven, but still, kilowatts of RF energy being applied to thousands and thousands of kinds of foods and other objects, but foods that can consume by human beings and other objects have been heated with a microwave oven for now 45 years, and to my knowledge, there is no evidence of any nuclear change ever taking place. Let me drop.
Well, I have a problem with that because we have a particle duality. You say it's affecting only the outer shell. Well, the particle, such as electron, could act as a wave or as a mass particle. That's why the microwave creates rotation. Vibration is infrared, and electronic excitation is ultraviolet, and bond breaking, which is the bound or nuclear bond breaking, is X-rays, and that's what the spectroscopy is based on. So what you're saying actually is in direct contradiction of what is being utilized.
Okay, let me try a direct question now, Wes. Do you believe a microwave oven has ever created a nuclear reaction? Was it the instigating force that made a change to a nucleus of atoms that were placed in that microwave oven? Is there evidence of that? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Everything that is that has anything to do with the nuclear structure is an atomic interaction. So we first have to specify what we have in mind. If we have a K shelf with 2 electrons, L shelf with 8 electrons, M shelf with 18 electrons, N with 32 electrons in any atom that has as many shells, that by losing one electron, it's an atomic interaction. Do you agree with it or not?
I think I disagree, and I'm going to ask a counter question. Do you believe a microwave oven has ever added or subtracted a proton from any atom ever placed in that microwave oven? Do you believe a microwave oven has ever added or subtracted a neutron from any atom that was placed in that microwave oven? Has it ever added or subtracted a proton? Has it ever added or subtracted a neutron? If the answer is no, and I think it's no, then I'm saying that for all practical purposes, I'm not convinced that a microwave oven has ever been the motivating force that created a nuclear change. Did it create a daughter? Did it change? I know it didn't change lead into gold, but you know what I mean. Has it ever changed one atom to another atom by adding or subtracting a proton or a neutron? N2XJN, K2LIW.
If the answer is no, I don't have the evidence based on the actual science. But the micro would be then 10 to minus 1 to 10 to minus 3. I mean, I'm trying to find out what is the range of the microwave that we operate with. Say with the, I was doing the experiment at first with 420 megahertz. Okay, then actually I scanned through from 100 megahertz to 500 megahertz. Then I went lower from about 60 megahertz to 100 to 500 megahertz. And I can state, based on all of my senses that I have, that I was able to see confirmation of the findings from 1956. Pattern that I'm working on that would be short, not going deep into it.
Because the microwave oven is a sealed cavity where, for all practical purposes, essentially none of the microwave energy that's poured into that cavity gets a chance to escape. All of it, per se, gets applied to the substance that has been put into the microwave oven. And so, because you're putting 750 watts, call it 750 joules per second, of microwave energy is being poured into the oven, and the vast majority of it is bouncing back and forth between the walls, so it probably is the equivalent of 5 or 10 kilowatts of energy that the food or other substance in there is being subjected to. If I calculate what that means in volts per meter, I'm convinced that as many thousands of volts per meter is the real E field and a corresponding H field taking place in that microwave oven. Let me drop, I'm going to show you where I'm going with this. The experiment that that is part of the patent that you have brought to our attention before is a vial of substance where electrodes on the side are the method by which a radio signal is being subjected to the substance in the vial, and that is an open-air experiment per se. It's not a six-sided, shielded microwave oven. That microwave oven, because of its shielding and the way the radio wave bounces in there losslessly, I'm convinced the microwave oven can be 1,000 or 10,000 or maybe 30,000 times stronger than anything you and I could safely create in an open environment of a vial with contacts on the end. So if radio waves are going to have an effect on substances, I think you're 1,000 times better to do it in a microwave oven than into open air. And microwave ovens have been doing that now for something like let me think now. I guess since Percy Spence did his experiment way back in 1947 or so, so that was like approximately 60 years ago. So for 60 some odd years, microwave ovens have been continuously used, and to my knowledge, there is no evidence of any nuclear change during all of those tens of decades of exposure of thousands and thousands of things. There's one other point I want to add to this one.
What is the frequency that is normally used in the microwave that you have
99.99% of all the microwave ovens in the United States and Canada, and probably much of Europe, are on almost exactly 2450 megahertz. 2.45 gigahertz is the exact frequency, plus or minus a couple of megacycles. That is the license-free band that they're operating at.
I was using 300 megahertz.
So, by the usual equation of E equals H nu, you were at roughly one-tenth the frequency, therefore each photon was one-tenth the amount of energy. So the combination of a lower frequency, less energy per photon, and out in open air, as opposed to a sealed cavity that's multiplying the RF energy by 1,000 or 10,000 times, I am convinced that if RF energy is going to do anything to a substance, it better be in something that looks like a microwave oven, otherwise you'll never get to the energy level required to do it.
Perfect, I agree with that.
And microwave ovens have been used now for 70 years, 60 years, and they haven't created any nuclear change that I know of. I think, John, you wanted to say something on this. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. In all your thousands of hours working with microwave frequencies and experiencing work with microwave ovens, have you ever heard or measured an emission of X-rays under linear action, of course?
Good question. I gotta go deep into it because I didn't read about it, but X-ray is a normal part of repositioning of electrons around the nuclei. So you cannot have something that is going on with this reposition and you're not going to have an X-ray. X-ray will be present, but what I'm saying is I was using frequency of the best response, about 300 megahertz, and that's the frequency of the patent. And I, well, maybe I should really ask John and Dick to see that and to explain.
I turned it over to Dick.
Yeah, I do have a partial answer for what you're asking, John. Of all my 40 years of experience with some pretty high-power microwaves that we used on rotary joints and airborne jamming transmitters and so on, the closest experiment I've ever seen that had some other optical effect taking place was there was a very high power, once again, 2.5 gigahertz Klystron amplifier feeding a piece of waveguide, and because of the way the particular experiment took place, periodically the waveguide would arc over. They were exceeding the 30,000 volts per centimeter of air normal breakdown, and the way the machine self-protected itself was that it would detect the arc and turn off the power supply so that the Klystron didn't get damaged by using ultraviolet detection. So there was an ultraviolet detector buried inside of the waveguide. When an arc took place, it saw the ultraviolet light, it said, aha, that's an arc, and it turned off the power supply. So I've seen ultraviolet light coming out of an arc. You and I have seen something similar. Lightning does it. Wimthurst machine does a beautiful job of making what probably is ultraviolet. My guess is you and I could set up an ultraviolet detector when we're running our Wimthurst machine, and I guarantee each one of those flashes, which is a breakdown in air, that does generate ultraviolet. And the way you've done experiments, you may have actually done that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No, that's one I haven't done. That sounds interesting. But what I was asking, with all your experience under linear operation, have you ever detected or heard about X-rays being produced with microwave production?
In order to make a X-ray, even a very soft X-ray, all the experience with cathode-grade tubes on the early color television sets say you've got to be above 30,000 volts to be an X-ray worth talking about. And very few of the high-power traveling wave tubes or Klystrons I've ever worked with go much above 15 or 20,000 volts. So if the voltage is not high enough, you don't have the raw E-field energy to generate an X-ray. To make an X-ray of any substantial strength, I think takes a healthy 100,000 volts to do it. If you're not doing it with 100,000 volts, I don't think you're getting an X-ray. I wonder if you've heard similar things, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, very similar. That would be a good thing for Wes to look into also, because I was just wondering, and you're right, I think a mild dental X-ray machine is around 110,000, somewhere around there, 120,000. So you're probably right.
You think about the X-ray created from the tungsten being absorbed by the electron. I'm talking about X-ray that is a part of the nuclear decay, and that must happen under the influence of an external source. That external source could be an electron, and it doesn't really take much to speed up the electron just to affect it. So when you have the...
I disagree with that one, Glenn. I mean, Wes. If you have a substance that is naturally radioactive and it feels like breaking down, it's going to do it when it feels like... Let me drop this. It's going to do it when it feels like. And if you, with external influence, want to take a natural radioactive substance and at your command you want it to speed up or slow down its natural nuclear decay, I think you can jump up and down, you can do... I think you can do anything you want and you can't affect it. This was technet number 1462 of the series. And I think I can say a couple more words by this means. So, people have tried, by thought experiments and electronic experiments, they tried to make a natural radioactive substance increase or decrease its rate of natural decay. And to my knowledge, they never even came close. And yes, you can penetrate a nucleus with a very high-speed electron that you've accelerated in a particle accelerator at close to the speed of light. And without getting close to the speed of light, that electron will just bounce off that outer shell of electrons of that atom and never get to the nucleus. To get to the nucleus, an extremely strong, hard, small target that has one hell of a shield of electrons around it. Very, very difficult. 73, you guys. We'll get a little closer to some kind of a truth next week, it says here. K2IIW and the TechNet, bye-bye, you all. Try to be kind to each other. Over to you, John, if you want to say anything. K2IIW.
Very good, Dick. I hope you can hear me. Yeah, next week maybe we'll talk a little more. But you enjoy the week, and I will talk to you and during the week probably. And I want to thank everybody for participating tonight. And Wes, you can check that stuff out because I'm quite interested. This is KC2WGB.
One last comment there, John. I am guessing you and I should get together in the next couple of days and have a further discussion like we did until 4 o'clock one morning about the experiment you're running. By now, you probably have some more things that you want to report and or ask about. Is that true? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. The question you asked, 6 dB per 100 foot for RG8, that's at 400 megahertz. I thought it was around 500. The actual number is 400 megahertz. And I'll be testing at the 100 milliwatt at around 390, somewhere around there. So I'll be close.
Okay, that sounds good. So one of these nights we'll get together and we'll talk about that some more. And I think the best experiment is going to take place by way of directional coupler and spectrum analyzer. But I'm afraid that that's going to be a little bit more difficult for our particular audience to accept that. They accept a Berg wattmeter. They're a little bit afraid of directional couplers because they've had so little exposure to them, is my experience. Over to you, John. Bye-bye for now. K2LIW.
Yeah, hard to understand because the bird is a directional coupler slug. So, alrighty. Enjoy. And, yeah, we'll definitely get together and speak again. Wes, over to you.
Of E3, the log, as they say. K2LIW.
Careful. Don't run into, caribou or something, you know?